Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC Radio and Cromwell Savings Bank. Now here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Thank you. And our guest tonight is the co-author of a new book called The Soaps, Daytime Serials of Radio and TV, David Rounds. David, it's a pleasure to have you here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Thank you.
By looking at you, I know you don't go back to the golden age of radio. You certainly never played in the radio soaps, did you?
No, but I very well could have.
Could you?
Oh, sure. Most people don't realize that the last soaps didn't go off till 61.
I suppose you're
so you
right.
You wouldn't have to be even have reached a majority to have listened, or even been on them, for that matter.
No, that's right. The last shows. Ed, what was the last show? Do you remember?
The very last show? I think it was The Couple Next Door, to be honest about it.
Or Ma Perkins, one of the two,
yes,
I guess.
Yes, and it's interesting you made that comment because the girl who played Peg Lynch's daughter, she did a play up here in this coach light, and she's only about 22, 23 years old, and she was a regular on a daytime soap. So there is a possibility you can be still quite young and have appeared.
There are many radio soap actors who are on the TV ones today. I saw Mason Adams just the other day on Love of Life playing a doctor. Mason Adams was Pepper Young for, I don't know, decades.
You know, we made this observation that the people who were in radio at its beginning were very young. They were in their late teens and early 20s. They had to, because most of them are still active today. Look at Gail Gordon, you know, who is co-featured with Lucy. And
well, in the book, I've got three pictures. I just love that. Three pictures of Virginia Payne. When she started Ma Perkins, she was about 21 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have publicity shots of her. I have one in here from 1937 with glasses and a gray wig. And then I have a picture of her taken the same year by Bruno of Hollywood where she looks like Pavlova. She looks about 16. And mm-hmm. the pictures were taken the same year. And then yeah. I have a picture of what she looks like today, and she still doesn't look as old as wish she was supposed to have as Ma Perkins in 1934.
That's right.
It's uncanny.
David Rounds is the co-author of the soaps, along with Madeline Edmondson. And, David, you did appear on television in the soaps. This is what got you started, I would assume.
Yes, it gets in the blood, as they say, about how do you get an elephant out of the theater. You know, you can't if it's in its blood. Well, Madeline was one of the ghostwriters, one of the dialoguers for the head writer of Love of Life in those same years that I was on it. She called up about 2 years ago to pick my brain about the backstage life, and I said I had thought of writing a similar piece because I think it's long overdue that somebody pays some attention to these things. They're not just water over the dam. They're things that we've got to begin to preserve. And so she said, why don't we do it together? So that's what started it.
Well, of course, I think that people have a tendency yet today to chuckle at the soap operas, and there's nothing really to chuckle at. There's some of the finest television on the air is produced in the form of soaps, in the way of acting, in the way of camera work. I'm not going to vouch necessarily for the writing, although I'm sure that the writers are very accomplished.
Well, I think percentage-wise, it's about the same thing. Now, the way I remember Love of Life, and I don't think things have changed from what I've seen much lately, if you were on, say, three or four times a week, you would get a really terrific scene, not just emotional or something that an actor likes to put his teeth into, but you would get a really terrifically well-written scene maybe once out of those 4 a week. Now, that's pretty good average, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It gives you a chance to express yourself. It also gives you a chance to live a fairly normal life for a while when you have one of these parts, I would assume.
Well, if you consider getting up at 5 a normal life, it's not for an actor.
Let's go back. Let's talk about our subject here, our favorite subject, the golden age of radio and the very beginnings of soap operas. Reading through the book, I discovered that Norman Brokenshire, in a sense, was responsible for the very beginnings of soap operas, not in the form that we know them, but in the accounting of the development of soaps, you indicated that one day he had to fill time, and he opened a book started to read it. Had a jog your memory there, didn't I? That's right, and that's what the soaps were all about. But the very first situations in that daytime void, and I guess that's what daytime radio was in the late 20s and early 30s. There wasn't very much on the air, was there?
Hygiene lectures.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah. Now, the very first were comedy situations, and I guess Jim Jordan, who later became Fibber McGee and Molly, was one of the pioneers.
Isn't it curious that the first forerunners of soaps, and indeed, to my mind, the best of the soaps from the Golden Age, were comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's many reasons, I think, why we don't get as much comedy today. I think it's a shame. I think it's harder to write, and I think it's harder to act if you have to memorize it, now that soaps are half an hour. Goodman Ace, just a couple of years ago, and a friend of mine decided, let's try a comic soap opera. Well, as you know, Easy Aces was one of the best. I don't know, that to me is not a legitimate soap opera, but it was in many senses of the word. And they finally decided that it could not be done. Comedy depends so much on timing that you just could not knock off one a day and the actors be that up and on top of the lines. It has to be quick, 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 banner, 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 ping pong ball time, mm-hmm. which you can do so well with those wonderful, all of them, Vic and Sade, Amos and Andy.
And, of course, a lot of the comedy was created in your imagination. You know, phone calls, repetitious phone calls, doors that opened, closets that opened. And,
closets that opened.
You know, that really are not visually very funny. I don't think that opening a closet door and seeing a lot of cardboard boxes come tumbling out is nearly as funny to watch as it is to hear.
Right.
That may be the very big difference.
Yeah, Amos and Andy, I think a good deal of their laughs came from the sound effects, the taxi cab and so forth, and you know, that did play a role, and that was certainly the king of the comedies, wouldn't you say, in the soaps, the Amos and Andy series?
And one of the pioneers, certainly.
Yeah, it started back in, 1928 or 1929?
Well, I think the one that surprised me in the reading was Vic and Sade. I mean, that was ridiculous stuff and very funny.
Yeah, in fact, I think it's acknowledged to be the best writing of all of the soaps was in Vic and Sade. Did you find that in your research, that it got that kind of acclaim as far
the
as...
Amos and Andy?
No, the Vic and Sade, the quality of the writing.
Oh, yes, Paul Reimer got many awards even during his time there for that incredible writing.
The getting back to Amos and Andy, they had their start, I guess, in 1929. They weren't known as Amos and Andy at first, were they?
No, they were Sam and Henry, Dick. And I think they, for some reason or other, they changed it because I think there was a comic strip by that name, wasn't there?
Well, the reason we found in the book is a legal one that we were talking about before. Who owns these shows once they're done? And they got an offer to go either to another station or to another network. I can't remember what the situation was. And the owner said no. So they just took the whole show and changed the names of the characters. It was exactly the same show,
yeah, same
but
voices,
they just changed the characters, so they legally kept a hold of it that way.
Well, Dick, I see you're really anxious to...
what is that you have before you,
Dick?
Yeah,
you have a book there.
I have
there,
a book.
You're looking at something.
You know, we talk about Amos and Andy, and I've got to quote from the book, if I may.
Dare.
Please, David. You say, today the kind of humor that sustained the show would be almost universally offensive, based as it was on racial stereotype and appealing as it did to the audience's smug assumption of its own infinitely superior sophistication and intelligence. And that was the basis of Amos and Andy. But there's something rather interesting here. I understand that Gosden and Carell were in great demand as speakers before black organizations during the 30s.
I'm sure of it. You see, I don't think it was offensive then. It's a question of now.
Yeah.
You know, in the liberal 50s, that's, I think it's a shame that ethnicism has gone out of out of fashion.
Of course, they themselves were very, very sensitive human beings, and people might say, well, then why did they create stereotype characters? But
you do have to think of it for their day.
That's right.
I found some publicity shots down at, I don't remember, NBC, I think, and it shows the two of them with little, well, you can only call them dolls. Very tasteless, what we would consider very tasteless today. But it wasn't then.
That's right. But they had a great foresight, in a sense. Listen to this script, and I'm going to read it as it was written, where Amos says to Andy, "You can't keep on beating the dog. Someday dat dog gonna turn on you. Down in de dog's heart, he might love you. But if you keep on beating him, and he loves you just the same, but he gonna turn on you." And then he goes on to say that... it's easy enough for you to tell me not to feel that way, but when somebody's always cutting you like they's cutting you with a knife, hurting your feelings and hurting your pride and everything else, it ain't so easy to say, let's forget it.
Right on.
Gee, it is
very
prolific, isn't it?
I would think so, yes. And they were giving us a message. There were other ethnic comedy situations, of course, the Goldbergs.
Molly Goldberg was fabulous, fabulous. The humor there again, and the insight into humanity. And another reason why it's a precursor of the classic soap form is that it had a very strong domestic situation, and the family was above everything. Above intelligence, above religion, above politics, above career. It's the family is all.
Ed, before we talk more about the soaps, suppose we listen to one. What one would you like to play for us?
Well, since we're in that early period, I don't have a copy of the Goldbergs because it's just unattainable, at least at the present time. But another one of that same period, which really got the ball rolling, was Mert and Marge. And I'd like to play that because it does sort of set the stage for what happened later on as the soaps developed, Dick.
The story of Mert and Marge. Things moved fast the last time we saw Mert and Marge. They had just left the theater after the big opening of the new Hayfield's Pleasure, you remember, when an attempt was made to hold them up. The girls were on their way to a party with Ray Hunt and Jack Arnold, the young assistant district attorney, who had helped Marge get her job with the Chick Chicks. Hunt managed to beat off the would-be holdup man, but not before Margie recognized the robber's voice as that of her foster brother, Jimmy Minter. It's a situation that's packed with dramatic possibilities, and in just a moment, we'll find out what they are in today's episode of the story of Mert and Marge. It's the following morning in Mert's apartment. The girls are sleeping.
Oh, that darn phone. I didn't sleep for a week. Hello? Oh, 11 o'clock. Thanks, operator. Send up all the morning papers, please. Yeah, thanks. Margie, wake up. Doesn't she look sweet? Just a little baby. Margie, wake up, honey. 11 o'clock, another day to do things.
Oh, you up already, Myrtle?
Just got up.
Oh, Myrtle, I was having the weirdest dream. The opening of the show and the holdup and the party all mixed up. Jimmy was holding up the party, and we were having it on the stage all in the first act.
Don't even talk about that hold-up, Margie. And if anyone asks you any questions, you don't know anything about it.
All right, Myrtle, I'll do as you say, but I'm awfully worried. And to think Jimmy tried to shoot us.
Well, stop worrying. After all, none of the shots even touched the car. Oh, I'll turn on your bath, Margie. Then I'll put on the coffee, and we'll find out what the critics have to say about the show while we're eating breakfast.
gosh, what a darn little apartment. Everything's so compact. Oh, this cute piano, all green and gold. Gosh.
Come on out and see my kitchen and dinette, Margie.
Oh, I adore this place. Oh, look, this little nook just seats four.
Well, you'd be surprised how many have been around that table when we've had a gang in for corned beef and cabbage or spaghetti.
You must be very happy here.
Yeah, I am. I guess I got an old-fashioned domestic streak. I love to cook. Do you want orange juice, tomato juice, or melon?
I love melon.
These are the old-fashioned mush kind.
Oh, Myrtle, I just happened to think.
What, dear?
Well, Mrs. Morris say about my not coming home last night.
Oh, I fixed that. I phoned her from Jack Arnold.
Oh, thanks, Myrtle.
Say, we'll have to hurry a bit, Margie. You know, we're called for 1 o'clock rehearsal.
Oh, I've got to go and turn the water off.
Oh, there's the morning papers. Just a minute.
Good morning, Kate.
Well, Clarence, what are you doing here?
Oh, I was just passing by the apartment, and I had a terrific idea. Simply devastating, so I came up to tell you.
Oh, hello, Clarence.
Hello, Marge. Oh, by the way, here are your papers, Mert. I took them from the elevator, man.
Thanks a lot.
Wonderful reviews. We're a hit. Definitely a hit.
Oh, that's wonderful. Say, what's your idea, Clarence?
Well, you know that scene in which Marge comes on stage dressed like a bride?
Oh, yeah.
Well, she's all dressed in white.
Well, isn't that the way brides generally dress, Clarence?
That's it, exactly. It's so trite. So I said to myself, why white? Why not cerise?
Cerise? Ye gods.
It'll be sensational. If I were in Hollywood, I'd be sure to get an Oscar for the idea.
Well, maybe you better talk to Ray Hunt, Clarence. Shoot the stunt the hunt. He's the man.
That's just what I'll do. He'll love it.
Well, now, don't think you're being evicted, Clarence, but we've got to get at rehearsal at 1 o'clock, you know.
Oh, I was just leaving anyway. I simply had to tell someone, though. Cerise. Oh, I always adored Cerise.
The Adventures of Mert and Marge. We'll get back to our guest, David Rahns, author of the new book, The Soaps, right after this message from our sponsor.
Now, to help your savings grow, Cromwell Savings Bank offers you 6 convenient savings plans, one of which might be just right for your financial needs. For example, there's Cromwell Savings 6-year Certificate of Deposit, which pays an annual interest rate of 7.75% with an effective annual yield of 8.17%. The minimum deposit is $1,000. For those people who might desire to invest for a shorter period of time, Cromwell Savings offers a 4-year certificate of deposit, which, with a minimum deposit of $1,000, has an annual interest rate of 7.50% and an effective yield per annum of 7.90%. Visit Cromwell Savings and get full information on any of their certificate of deposit savings plans. Under federal regulations, certificates of deposit may not be redeemed before maturity without a penalty charge being imposed. Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, where your savings are insured up to $40,000. Corner of Main and West Streets, Cromwell.
David, the soap opera, as we know it today, had its start in Chicago, didn't it?
Right. Cincinnati, Cincinnati, the home of Procter & Gamble, which is one of the earliest sponsors. Mm-hmm. As indeed were other soap companies, which is why they're called soap operas.
No kidding, I never knew that.
Yeah. A lot of people ask me, why are they called soap operas?
And a young lady by the name of Erna Phillips really gave soap opera its start in Chicago. Tell me about Erna.
Incredible lady. Queen of the soap writers. She passed away only recently at the age of 74, and was still active in TV soaps, and you will still see her name on the credit roll for, I have to think quickly, As the World Turns, Another World, and I think a couple others.
She was a consultant, I guess.
Well, and in a couple of cases, the creator, the original mm-hmm. idea creator, yeah. Mm-hmm. And very active in radio from 1932,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
What happened? How did she get started?
I have to look in my book.
You don't have a photographic memory, then.
I think the first one was Painted Dreams. I don't know which shortly after its initial existence.
Yeah, it was Painted Dreams, as a matter of fact, on WGN, I think.
Right. But there's a quote from that that I just think will show you how soap operas have not changed
mm-hmm.
at all in their basic philosophies. I seem to have found the wrong page. So you talk about something else while I find Erna Phillips in Painted Dreams. She's not your most attractive lady, but she sure was prolific and as bright as a whip, and she kept control. Wow. She always lived in Chicago. She never,
mm-hmm.
never moved to New York. And in the last 20 years, if a character was coming up that was going to be of any duration, a running character, as they call it, they would, instead of her coming to New York to see the various actors, because she always kept her finger in everywhere, which a writer does not always, they would stick the chosen actor or actress on a program as a bellboy or a secretary, just so Erna Phillips could watch her in Chicago and say yes or no, I like her, I don't like her, and
mm-hmm.
then a few weeks she'd be back in the regular part.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah.
There were three major writing groups, you might call it. There was Erna Phillips, there was the Hummets, and Elaine Carrington. And I think between the three of them, they probably wrote 80% of all of the soaps that were on the air. And maybe you might comment a bit on the styles or you know the way that each one kind of differed in their approach to writing soaps as one opposed to the other.
Well, you're probably more more prepared to do that than I.
Well, I noticed like Elaine Carrington could dictate and never hear what she dictated. She'd dictate into a machine, it would be transcribed and go on the air, and she'd never hear the readback or how it sounded. It was just a one-shotter, and that's kind of amazing because if you study playwrights like Morse Hart or Kaufman, they can take months and months to get one act of a play, you know, so it reads properly. And yet, this one was able to grind this stuff out almost at will. And
keeping how many different plots in mind because of the various shows she had on the air?
Yeah, maybe a half a dozen, and just knock off one and go to the next, and just without a break. And she only worked about 4 hours a day, according to your book. She didn't really spend that much time. She just spilled it out and right on.
Talk
to
her son and her daughter. She would wander off during the day. Say, "Excuse me," she'd go off to this little studio she had in the back of the property, and as fast as she could talk into that machine, that's as fast as she wrote.
Mm-hmm. 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 Erna Phillips started this idea, I guess, of pool writing. She herself was doing all of the writing
at
first.
She stole that from Alexander Dumas, Dick, according to the book. Anyway,
yeah.
He had 70 writers that helped
make
up those 280 volumes he's credited with, you know.
That's right. He was the first one to farm it out, I guess.
So she got the credit, but she didn't do all the work.
Have you found the place yet?
working on it.
Well, maybe we can talk about the Hummets, because we've had a lot of people
who worked with them. Well, that was the real factory.
Yeah, and they had certain rules, which are very, very strict. Each individual had to pronounce their words exactly in a very, you know, very well-modulated voice. You could never interrupt the other person. That was forbidden. And, of course, any of these words which you hear today, pregnant and sex and so forth, absolutely forbidden. So they ran a very tight ship, and they didn't care for practical jokers either because...
very little humor.
They had no humor whatsoever.
They were millionaires by the late 1930s.
A wonderful story that we recount in the book here. We call her the redoubtable Anne Hummert. She once told one of her dialoguers, "I want you to put God on every page." That was their philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
The writer, unfortunately, responded, "Who will play the part?"
Mm-hmm.
and was promptly fired.
That's what you're mm-hmm. saying. No sense of humor.
They were rather generous at Christmas time, I understand, with their staff. They gave boxes of cookies to to the writers and so on. But and also the presentation, according to the book, the presentation of the script was unlike anything that anyone else did. Each script had a cover page. Do you remember?
In lavender ink, I think,
mm-hmm.
wasn't that it?
Yeah, yeah. And it was made very clear that this was a property of the Hummerts, and no one was about to steal any portion thereof. You know, I think it would be wonderful to hear excerpts from each of these writers, or as our producer Brian Hartnett refers to them, factories. But I know that we don't have anything that, in your collection at least, Ed, from Erna Phillips from the early days. In the book, you have quoted from Erna Phillips, though, haven't you, David?
Yes, we have. Now, I mentioned before about Kazin and Correll having to change the names of their characters. Well, the same thing happened Erna Phillips created a show called Painted Dreams. And when she wanted to move it to another show, she went through the same thing. So she took all the characters with her and decided to call it Today's Children. Now, you may remember that title. Now you're with me. Well, the leading lady, of course, was Mother Maran, don't you know? And she had a daughter who was an artist. Now, this speech, mind you, is uncanny because it is absolutely the philosophy of Erna Phillips and really is the philosophy of the soaps. And Frances, the elder daughter, she was an artist. She complained to her mother that she didn't see why a wedding ring should interfere with the realization of the dream that she had painted about her life. And Mother Maran replied, this is motherhood right down the line. She said, Frances, you're painting your dreams, yes. And you hold the brush and must be choosing the colors to use. But when you're painting your dreams, be careful of the colors you're going to use. Because sometimes you make a mistake, and the colors that you think are going to look good don't look so good in the finished picture. Now, Frances, darling, let me be saying just one more thing to you. There are three colors that have stood the test of all time. They are the colors that are the foundation of all dreams of all the men and women in the world. The colors of love, family, and home.
That's beautiful. They left out amnesia. They left out all of the other horrible things that happened to the characters. But
well, it's the Hummers.
I'm going to wipe
my
eye. The
Hummers
were
very big on amnesia, I think.
Yes, that
were much
was one
more
of the,
melodramatic.
Yeah, we were concerned with infantile paralysis in real life during the 30s, and they were concerned with trying to conquer amnesia on the soaps. But I understand your favorite soap is Rosemary.
Well, it's my favorite in the sense that it is most typical, say, of Elaine Carrington's work. Mm-hmm. And it is your love story. It is not comic or ethnic. It is the real, true, sudsy detergent soap.
Can we hear Rosemary?
Oh, I hope so.
Yes, I think I can fulfill that, Dick.
Rosemary, written by Elaine Carrington, author of Pepper Young's Family and When a Girl Marries, is dedicated to all the women of today. Yes, Rosemary is your story. This is you. It's been many weeks now since Dennis, the man from nowhere, first brought word to the little white Cape Cod cottage on the Newtown Road that Lewis Dawson, Mrs. Dawson's husband, whom she thought dead so many years ago, was alive and seriously ill in New York. At first, she refused to believe the words of the stranger, but when he told her so many intimate details of her husband, Mrs. Dawson believed him. Believed him enough to mortgage the house Rosemary had given her. And without telling the facts to her daughters, Rosemary and little Patty had left for New York with the stranger. The money she had secured secretly, safely sewed in the lining of her coat. And now, the moment has come that Mrs. Dawson has long waited for, long feared. The moment when at last she's to see the man who calls himself Lewis Dawson, the man who claims to be her husband. And as she mounts the black stairs of the boarding house in New York, her knees trembling, her hands cold as ice, her heart thundering in her breast, she says over and over to herself,
"Let it be Lewis. How dare God let it be Lewis? Let him call me Susie, and then I'll know. Let him talk about things in the past that no one but Lewis and I can know about. Then I'll be sure. I must be sure. Oh, please, God, let this man be Lewis."
Well, Lewis, she's here. Your wife is here.
Are you really my husband? Are you really Lewis?
Susie, girl.
Oh, Lewis, my darling, it is you. No one but you could know that name for me. No one but you. Oh, Lewis, you're here, you're alive. I found you.
Hey, take it easy, Mrs. Dawson. He's not very strong, you know.
That's all right, Dennis. I feel better now that she's here. I feel like my old self again. Oh, Susie, girl, to think you came all this way to have a
baby. Oh, I'm sorry to cry like this. I was so afraid. I didn't know. I couldn't be sure.
Oh, sure. He knows how you feel, don't you, Louis?
Yes, I know how she feels.
I'm all right now. Don't worry, Mr. Dennis. I won't break down again.
Well, I hope not, on account of it's bad for him.
No. I'm all right now that she's here. Let me look at you, Susie girl. If Dennis puts a strong light on you, I can make out the outline.
Oh, please, Louis. You've had to go through all this alone.
Yes, but that's over now. You're here.
Suppose I leave the two of you together for a while, and then when I think he ought to take his rest, I'll come back again. How about it?
Yes, I'd like to be alone with my husband.
And don't worry about me, Dennis. You've been a good friend, but now my wife will look after
me. Oh, yes, Louis, I'll look after you for the rest of your life.
Susie, girl.
The doctor will be here in a little while, Mrs. Dawson. I'll let you know when. Then you can talk to him.
Doctors. I'm sick of doctors.
Would you like me to take your coat, Mrs. Dawson? I can hang it up for
my
you.
My coat? No, thank you. I'll just put it here. Thank you very much.
Well, you better take it off. It's kind of warm in here.
Yes, I will. In just a minute. Thank you, Mr. Dennis. If you'll leave us alone.
Yeah, sure, you bet. I can't tell you how glad I am you're here to see to him. Now then, Louis, you take it easy. Don't try to talk too much. Just take it easy.
Yeah, Dennis, I'll take it easy.
Listen tomorrow to Rosemary by one of radio's greatest writers, Elaine Carrington. Same time, same station.
Ah, the story of Rosemary. A delightful tale. All right, we'll return to our guest, David Rounds, author of The Soaps, right after this message.
Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
With the ever-increasing cost of living, it's harder to save these days, yet it's more important than ever to make that extra sacrifice to save. Why? Because tomorrow's dreams will still be financed with today's savings. Cromwell Savings Bank suggests that whatever the amount, you save on a regular weekly basis. It's a good habit that you'll be thankful you acquired. Visit Cromwell Savings and inquire about any of their 6 convenient savings plans.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, where you can now save Saturday mornings from 9 to 12 noon. Plenty of free parking available.
You know, you don't have to be a woman to be familiar with the soaps, because I guess I've told this story. Everybody has had the same experience. You know, when we were growing up, you'd come down with the measles during the springtime, and you'd be out for 3 weeks, and you'd listen to these stories on the radio. And the following year, you'd come down with a chicken pox or the whooping cough or whatever it is, and you'd pick it right up, you know, and it would be beautiful. You'd be able to listen to David Harum. And one of the things that the Hummerts were always involved in was a conflict of position. Stella Dallas was always afraid to be near Lolly Baby because Lolly Baby was so much better than she was.
Ah, well, of course, there are only so many basic plots. And one of the significant running consistent plots in soap opera is the difference in social level. And it happened again and again and is still happening. Stella was afraid that her poor background would interfere with Lolly Baby's life, since mm-hmm. she married above her station.
Mm-hmm.
When a girl marries is all about a girl marrying below her station. Differences in culture, like Mary Noble getting
Mary
along
Noble?
With her glamorous husband, who's in the New York theater.
Big shot in New York, right? And you see
Sunday and Lord Henry Brinthrop. You see, it's a very consistent.
Even just plain Bill, I didn't realize there was a difference in station there. And I understand his daughter was well-educated in the East.
Well, he was, of course, both the barber and the mayor, mm-hmm. so he got his nose into everything.
Except cutting hair. He never did it on the air. He did.
You never did hear those scissors
no,
go, did you?
I'm afraid not.
We're going to hear from the romance of Helen Trent. But before we do, I've got to ask you, David, about the unusual situation that Helen found herself in. And, of course, in radio, you could do these ridiculous things. I remember Stella Dallas in a submarine in the Suez Canal. And The situation that you're about to recall with...
Well, I only remember Helen Trent once being abducted by an ape, which you think now, so I don't remember anything like that. Well, that's... movies were doing that at the same time. That wasn't considered outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
This happened. Could happen to you, for heaven's sake.
Happened to Faye Ray, didn't it? Right.
That's right. Up there on the top of the Empire State Building. And, of course, you didn't have to create an ape. You just sounded like one.
What does an ape sound like when it's in the room?
I don't know. Can you help us with one
You're
of
doing
your
a very good job.
Do you happen to have that episode?
Oh, no, I'm afraid. That's asking for the moon. But I do have a romance of Helen Trent, which we can at least hear what the what it was like in those
Fabulous.
Days.
Fabulous.
Anyway.
Oh, she was pursued forever by Gil Whitney.
Again, the romance of Helen Trent. Seeking to reestablish herself in the confidence of the Hollywood Motion Picture Studios, Helen is designing the costumes for a forthcoming Broadway show, and she is sharing her penthouse with Julie Downing, who is to play the ingenue lead in the show. Recently, Michael Fallon, the eminent portrait painter with whom Julie is in love, returned from Ireland. But Michael has brought about a dangerous situation now. For from the first moment he met Helen, he has been secretly more interested in her than in Julie, although Julie, blissfully unaware of this as yet, is happy in what she believes to be the security of Michael's affection. It is mid-afternoon today as we look in on Helen's living room where we find her talking with songwriter Ken McKenzie. Listen.
You know, Ken, today almost calls for a celebration.
Yeah, how's that, Helen?
This morning I finished my very last costume design. No more drawings.
Well...
No more long hours of being buried in my den in there. From now on, all I have to do is work down at the theater with the costumes themselves.
Well, good for you, neighbor. I know that's a load off your mind.
Oh, it is. I feel like heaving one enormous sigh of relief.
I bet. Say, you know, Steve's tickled to death with your costumes, Helen. Yesterday, down at his office, he launched into a long epic of praise about you. Used all the adjectives. You should have heard it.
I'm glad he's pleased. I feel like I've done a good job, Ken. I certainly hope I have.
Mm-hmm. So you're going over to Philadelphia for the opening of the show?
Oh, you bet I am. I'll be right there. And then on opening night here in New York, I'll entertain some people at the theater. Meg and David Willoughby and Alice Carroll and Dr. North.
Mm-hmm.
Have to do this opening up brown, you know.
Oh, yes, by all means.
Ken, I've got a sure hunch about that tune called Julie you've written for the show.
Yeah? What's the sure hunch?
Oh, the way everybody down at the theater sings it and hums it all the time. The way they all love it. Ken, that song's going to sweep this country. Well, like Music Goes Round and Round did, or some of the other songs that have just been terrifically popular hits. You're going to be my most famous acquaintance before long, Mr. McKenzie. You know that?
I don't know, Helen.
Well, you are.
You know, I kind of regret calling that song Julie. Wish I'd have made it Susie or most anything else.
Now, why?
Oh, I get ribbed about it pretty much. Well, not that I mind, of course, but... By the way, I met the Fallon yesterday.
Did you?
Finally. He and Julie were walking up 44th Street, and I ran into them.
How did you like Michael, Ken?
Well, if Julie's picked him, I guess he's okay. Hey, look, what goes on, Helen?
What do you mean?
I mean about Julie. She's going around in a perpetual glow. For a while, after Michael got here, I knew darn well something was wrong, but here lately, Julie's beamingly, blissfully happy. Why the sudden change?
Well, I don't know, Ken. I guess she's just awfully happy for... general reasons.
Mm-hmm.
She and Michael seem to...
Oh, hi.
Well, hi, yourself.
What are you all doing? Michael's downstairs in the car, and we're going on a picnic. I just ran up to get some things, and I'm in sort of a hurry. Excuse me if I sort of dash
hey,
in and out.
Steve wants you to phone in, Julie.
Oh, thanks, Helen. I'll call him later. Well, hello, Miss Anthony.
Oh, hello, Julie. Just sitting here sewing in your room for a while. You know, I think this is the coolest one in the place this afternoon.
Well, help yourself, Miss Anthony. I've just come in to get a scarf to tie around my hair and get Michael's camera. Oh, well, I won't be here for dinner tonight, Miss Anthony.
Oh, won't you?
Mm-mm. Michael and I have had the bright idea of a picnic. He knows a place about an hour's drive up the Hudson where we can have a little trout season all to ourselves with waterfalls and big rocks to sit on, and he can sketch and I can read, and then we'll have supper. Doesn't that sound marvelous?
Well, that's fine. Don't you want Lucinda to fix you up some sandwiches?
Oh, no, thanks, darling. Michael had a place downtown fix up some stuff. Where the dickens did I put my blue scarf? Oh, I think it's in the closet.
Julie, I haven't seen you for the past few days, and I haven't laid eyes on Michael.
I'll tell you a secret, Miss Anthony. Michael and I are... Well, you see, we were away from each other so long while he was over in Ireland that now that we're together again, Michael says he wants to sort of... Well, we'll make a world that doesn't have anybody in it but us.
The Story of Helen Trent. Our guest is David Rahns, author of the new book, The Soaps, and we'll get back to that story right after this message.
The folks at Cromwell Savings Bank believe that it should be as easy as possible for their customers to save. To make it easy, Cromwell Savings offers you 6 different savings plans, one of which is sure to fit into your financial picture. Whether it's a 6-year certificate of deposit or a regular Cromwell Savings account which pays an annual interest rate of 5.25% and has an annual yield of 5.47%, your savings account at Cromwell Savings are insured up to $40,000. To make savings easier, too, Cromwell Savings is conveniently open Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., Thursdays from 9 to 5 p.m., Fridays from 9 to 7:30 p.m., and now on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 12 noon. So visit Cromwell Savings Bank and get complete information on how easy it is to get into the savings habit. Cromwell Savings Bank, corner of Main and West Streets, Cromwell, has been serving Connecticut people since 1871. They'd like to serve you, too.
Our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio is David Rahns, author of the new book, The Soaps. And I think that it's marvelous that this form, which is purely American in creation, has been documented in book form. Is this one of the reasons you decided to write it?
Right. Thank you. We thought it was about time. We don't mean it to be only nostalgic for the people who remember, which is just about everybody alive, but we mean for it to be attractive to the people who wondered what those other people saw in it, the people who go around scoffing, scorning, because I think there's more to it than meets the eye, not only as entertainment, which I believe it basically should be looked at as pure entertainment, but as a reflection of our society then, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and today.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you had to capsulize for some Martian in 1,000 years, life in the middle of the 19th century, you could show them a half an hour of a soap opera, and you'd just about have it.
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
More so than the movies. I think the movies tended to exaggerate more so. I think they were more true to life. I certainly
agree. Well, I agree with you.
Yes.
We always get the thing, they're not real, and I will take up an argument about that with anybody.
Of course, one of my very closest friends and... an associate of mine and with whom I went to college to major in this field is Dick McHugh, who directs Another World.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know him or not, but he is one of the co-directors, and they, as you know, they alternate two directors on a program, and he takes that very seriously.
Oh, you do? Know? Well, they do.
And tell me, I want to ask you a question here. He indicated to me that, maybe I'm talking out of school here, but he indicated to me that actors can become very neurotic.
Oh, no, no.
That they can actually develop the symptoms that they are supposed to be developing in the script.
Oh, I knew you'd say that. Now, I never molested anybody, but I will say that with that kind of intensive, you really do have an alternate life with a mm-hmm. half an hour a day, and if you're on 3, 4, sometimes 5 times a week, and you breathe that thing, even when you're sleeping, because you're madly trying to remember your words for the next day, it is a part of you. I'm not saying it's schizophrenic or Jekyll and Hyde or whatever, but I played such a nervous character on Love of Life,
And you were a child molester. That's why,
right.
Yeah.
No. Suspected.
Oh.
That I did.
Had a good lawyer.
It made me pretty much of a nervous wreck.
I would think it would.
You tend to get the physical symptoms. You know, it's so tight, emotional. You can't help but upset something, your digestion, if nothing else.
Let's turn to the chapter, The Twilight of the Soaps. They began to disappear from the air in the 60s. They did last longer than just about any other form of radio drama, didn't they, Ed?
I think they did. There were certainly only a handful of nighttime dramas on when they finally gave up the ghost. And I guess along those lines, we want to ask you, why so few of them didn't make it in television? Young Widow Brown went off the air. Why didn't they simply say that we're going to transfer it to the tube and now you can watch it?
Well,
every
day, they tried. You know? I can't name you any at the moment, but there were some that had simultaneous broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
They would have it on television at the same time as on radio. Well, you see, it was so new. People said, no, it'll never work. Nobody's going to sit down and watch a soap. That was one thing. Nobody's going to take the time, they figured. Also, they figured, it would be so limiting. You could only have, as it turns out, what they have today is like three sets is about the limit you can pull because of expense of a day. When you're used to having Ma Perkins and Shuffle walk down the street to the lumber yard, well, you're not going to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So they figured it'll never work. So everything was experimental. And I really think it's sheer accident that the only one left today that was actually from radio is Guiding Light. Now, its story is completely different, as your producer pointed out to us. But then again, for instance, Love is a Many Splendid Thing, which is the last television soap I was on about a year and a half ago, went off the air. Well, if anybody turned that on who had seen the movie except for the theme song, there were no Orientals. I mean, they dropped that story pack like that. It was such a hot potato.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think even daytime serials, and I do think daytime serials will take up subject matters that nighttime is still afraid of, could survive mixed marriage. But that was 5 years ago. Nowadays, they probably would.
Well, as you pointed out, one of the problems was expense. They just felt that they couldn't produce a television show.
It cost them $10,000. Well, that was a phenomenal fee. It would never work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, of course, the money now is one of the prime sources of income for the networks.
Well, how about Vic and Sid? Now, that show generally was played right in the living room. There was, you know, it was kind of a Holmesy thing. And I wonder whether when they saw the people in real life, whether they might have destroyed the image that they had in their
mind. Well, that's what they thought, too. Oh, the image that a listener would have of her leading lady could not possibly be matched by the real-life person, and they thought that would never do either. Mm. Well, of course, they're wrong.
Well, they were wrong, but of course new characters were created for television, and then it was discovered that soap operas take place in probably only two or three different places anyway. The home, the office, and the doctor's office, right?
Psychiatrist's office, too, yeah.
The hospital, right.
Right, the hospital,
you
right.
You must be a real dedicated watcher to make that observation.
Now they have cars every now and again. Now, that is incredible. Speaking of people listening on radio and how the listener's imagination will fill things out, it happens on the television, too. You'd be surprised. They have that car which they haul into the studio.
Mm-hmm.
They put it up on blocks. There's a little drop behind it. There may or may not be a movie going on behind, so it looks like there's a road swishing past.
Or lights moving
past. And
then
they'll have a flashlight whisking across your face.
Mm-hmm.
And people at home, if they're not in on the backstage way of things, will be convinced that that car is on a road.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I love the... We go into a whole production thing, and in my day on Love of Life, was just before Love of Life went to color. Love of Life was one of the last daytime soaps to go to color. And it was before they moved into the big production center on West 57th Street in New York. But Roy Windsor, I'm getting into television now.
That's all right. Go ahead.
Made a lot of money. He created, as the World Turns, which he got rid of very soon, but the two big ones he was famous for were Secret Storm, which unfortunately is going off for I don't know what reason, and Love of Life. Now, he had a production technique which was quite unusual and very cheap, which was that every room... every set was built out of black velour and had a gray wainscoting all around the walls.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, there was actually no wall. There was just this gray wainscoting. And you could hang a picture in midair, And when the camera looked and saw this wainscoting and this picture, the home audience eye filled in that wall. Instantly, there was a wall.
Not quite.
You weren't fooled.
I never fooled you for a minute, eh?
No, I tell you, until this very moment, I was fooled as to why they were black, because I just thought that it would be easier if everything were uniform. But it drove me crazy, because I felt that it was unrealistic. I guess it was...
Well, it wouldn't have driven you crazy if you were Roy Windsor and making a lot of money.
I suppose. Uh-huh. I suppose.
Well, of course, color knocked that entirely out.
Mm-hmm.
It also nearly knocked me out, because as a new actor on the soaps, I don't know if you've done much television acting, but they do have teleprompters on the cameras.
Mm-hmm.
But it's aside from your acting job, it's a whole other thing how to learn to look at them without America knowing you're looking at them. Which is the other thing. They said you could never do television soaps because how would the actors ever learn all those lines?
That's right.
Well, the point is they don't always learn all those lines. But I remember the first time I went up in my words and sat there and said to myself, I don't know what I am supposed to say next. But I was very cool about it. I said, shh, what the? I mean, I'm just going to sit here and I will look up and I will look over at that camera and I will read off the teleprompter and nobody will ever know. Well, the teleprompter had gone behind this wainscoting and there was a secretary, a large desk. So I could see the camera okay, but the prompter was directly behind the desk and I mm-hmm. just looked over there and I said, I can't see the prompter. Now what am I going to do? Well, like any other acting, if you just think a little harder, it'll come to you. You'll work it out.
Sure. And of course, the other actor will tend to help you out if he or she
right,
can.
Right, and it always looks like he's the one that's flubbed whenever you try to save
somebody.
He's
bailing you out.
Yeah.
Well, would you like to have, you know, if this were possible, David, would you like to have worked in radio on the soaps at all? Do you?
Well, now, I'm still thinking of it. Mm-hmm. I think there's room for radio soaps. As a matter of fact, we have discovered all of Elaine Carrington's scripts, which I think is pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
The recordings don't exist. And there indeed may be a lot of Erna Phillips scripts, but I'll bet you now that she's only recently passed away, they're all going to be tied up in litigation probably for years. But I'll bet you, knowing her reputation, she's got them somewhere in some garage. So we're thinking, my partner and I, Madeline, because of our experience in the research for our book, The Soaps Here, that maybe we could go back and start again from, pick one up from 1936 and do it straight, do it for real. Not only for nostalgic value, because the thing that really surprised me, and I hope maybe some of the excerpts we've played for you today will back it up, is the high quality of the writing. Super.
David Rounds, thank you very much for being our guest here on The Golden Age of Radio and talking about your new book, The Soaps. And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Bank, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell, a friendly bank in a friendly town. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bill Grasty and Dick Bertel.
Presents the Charlie McCarthy Show. Gentlemen, greeting you from Hollywood, California. On behalf of Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy, Mortimer Stern.